KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim, in for Michael Krasny. MSNBC Live anchor Katie Turr has a new memoir out. It's all about her year and a half covering Donald Trump's presidential campaign. Turr will be on the show to share campaign gossip and stories about how candidate Trump kept hassling her on the campaign and at campaign rallies. In one instance in South Carolina in December 2015, Trump called her Little Katie and goaded rally-goers to boo her. It got so ugly, she needed the Secret Service to help get her out. Turr joins us in studio to talk about Unbelievable, My Front Row Seat in the Craziest Campaign in American History. That's coming up after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Queenie Kim, in for Michael Krasny. When NBC News and MSNBC correspondent Katie Turr was assigned to cover the Trump presidential campaign, her editors assured her it would be short term, no more than 6 weeks. 40 states, and a year and a half later, Donald Trump was elected president. Now Turr has published a memoir called Unbelievable, My Front Row Seat to the Craziest Campaign in American History. It's full of campaign trail gossip and stories of being singled out by Trump at campaign rallies. Turr joins us here in the studio to discuss her experiences with Trump, today's media landscape, and the latest political news. Katie Turr, welcome to Forum.
Thank you for having me, Queenie.
So let's start with the latest political news, or it passes as political news these days. I guess on Sunday, President Trump took to Twitter to retweet a GIF. It shows the president teeing off at a golf course, and then we see footage of Hillary Clinton stumbling as she enters a plane. And the GIF has been photoshopped to make it look like the president's ball hits Clinton, and therefore she stumbles onto that plane. And I saw that Twitter and some pundits in the media were sort of outraged about this as yet another example of Trump sort of being not very friendly to women. But I have to say, I sort of looked at it and I was sort of like, huh, and I just sort of swiped my screen and didn't even bother clicking. And I'm wondering if that attitude is a little insidious.
Is it a normalization of the behavior?
Yeah.
That is a good question. And I think in some ways, in many ways, yes, it is a normalization of the behavior, because I felt the same way just looking at it, thinking, of course he's doing this, and then moving on. But then I remember taking a step back and watching as everybody was debating whether or not a retweet was an endorsement, and thinking, this is where we are in our political reality, our political surreality, where we have to decide whether the president of the United States meant any violence towards his former opponent when he retweeted a GIF from a Donald Trump supporter, a, you know, you could argue violent GIF, or you could say just joking GIF. Either way, this is the president of the United States. This is not the host of The Apprentice. This is not what we would normally expect the leader of not only the United States, but the leader of the free world, the day before he's going to address the UN, while we're facing all these dire threats from North Korea, while we're still doing cleanup from hurricanes Irma and Harvey, when another one is coming up the coast, another one is facing Puerto Rico. Is this what we should be talking about? Is this how our president should be behaving? Is this what he should be spending even a second of his time on?
Yeah, and the reason I brought it up is not just because it's the latest news, but it sort of reminds me of the beginning of your book. I guess I mentioned that retweet because you say in the prologue to your book, it starts on Trump's Election Day victory party in New York. And according to the timestamp, it's 10:30 p.m. You're in the party there, and it looks like he might win. And the first lines you write in your book or in that prologue are, "I'm about to throw up." Why those lines, and what did you mean by that?
Because I was about to throw up.
And in some ways, because you foreshadowed some of this.
And it was intended to bring the reader to that moment and remind everybody what it was like when Donald Trump won. I don't think a lot of people had a reaction. Certainly my reaction was not a partisan reaction.
Mm-hmm. And
if you just
won or lost.
If you just read that line, you might read it as a partisan reaction. And congratulations, you've read the first line of the book. You should keep reading and figure out why I was feeling so nauseous. It wasn't because Donald Trump was a Republican and I wanted a Democrat to win or an independent to win. It was because of the past year and a half and this feeling that facts no longer mattered, that what we were reporting on no longer mattered. Our jobs felt like they were, journalism felt like it was under attack, like we didn't mean anything. I had been personally under attack. I had received death threats. I hadn't slept in over 500 days. It was that in combination with, oh my God, this lifestyle I've been leading is never going to end. Mm-hmm. And the feeling that I think a lot of voters had was, is this you know, mile a minute headline making machine, this controversy making machine, is this the way we are going to live for the next 4 years?
So it was sort of just more of a general. What I really liked about it is sort of like a foreshadowing of what we're seeing now, which is sort of what's unfolding, is that we're talking about these tweets,
yeah.
and we're sort of talking about what sort of is the
stuff
of reality shows.
Trying to make sense of him constantly. That's what it was like on the campaign trail, trying to make sense of Donald Trump, trying to make sense of his support. And it was, I think, a very correct feeling that this is not going to change. Anybody who thought Donald Trump was going to assume the Oval Office and then suddenly change as a human being, I think was being a hopeful person, but was not being honest with themselves. Because Donald Trump is, what is he, 71 years old now? It's very hard to get a 71-year-old man to change. This is the way he has always been. And it is the way that he will continue to be, no matter who you surround him with.
And I guess one of the things that we've seen from this president is that, you know, we've heard that he breaks the rules. He doesn't sort of abide by the basic decorum. He's gone after the mainstream media in a way that probably no president in recent history has. And I guess in that narrative of the fake news, you somehow became one of the villains of the fake news, I guess, mafia, he would call it, or the media. And that pretty much started on day one of covering him when you were rushed up to New Hampshire. That was May 23rd, 2015. It was 535 days before the election. And tell us how you got that assignment and sort of your first taste of this.
It was June 30th, 2015.
Okay, sorry.
Donald Trump announced, I believe, on June 16th, 2015. And I was in New York, and the bosses saw me standing around literally and said, why don't you do a couple stories on Donald Trump? He had been facing controversy with his election announcement, saying that Mexico was sending rapists into the country. Univision dropped him. Macy's dropped him. NBC dropped his pageant, and they needed a reporter to cover it. So they assigned me. After a couple days, when the headlines weren't going away, they said, you know what, let's put somebody on this campaign full time. And they looked and they said, you know what, why don't we have Katie do it? I was in town from London. I was only supposed to be there for a few weeks. But nobody at that time was taking Donald Trump seriously. There was a feeling that he would drop out before he had to release his financial information. Or if he made it to one of the debates, he would get laughed off the stage. So I went into this thinking, well, I guess I'm going to spend a few weeks of my summer. And I guess they don't take me so seriously, because if they did, they would have put me on Jeb Bush. And I went up to that rally in New Hampshire. It was just a couple hundred people around a backyard pool, very unlike what we became accustomed to seeing from Donald Trump. And he's spitballing on stage, running through what would become his core campaign ideas. He was defending his comments, saying that Mexico was sending rapists. He was going after the media. And oh yeah, he was bragging about his crowd sizes and how he always gets standing ovations. It was almost word for word what you would end up hearing. And suddenly I hear my name. I've never met Donald Trump. I didn't know him at all. I knew that he was the host of The Apprentice, and that he had a big reputation in the New York tabloids.
But
I didn't think
you.
That he knew me. He had no reason to know me in my mind, but he apparently did.
Yeah, and he says, and you're sort of sitting there tweeting and trying to write down everything he's saying so you could tweet it out, and he says, Katie, you haven't even looked up once at me.
You're not paying attention to me, essentially. And I remember screaming out at him because this is Donald Trump. I mean, this is what you do. If somebody goes after you and calls you out with a big personality like that, you go after them right back. You don't back down. It's what I've always done in my life when I've been faced with those sorts of personalities. And so I yell back, I'm tweeting what you're saying. You're not going to bully me. You're not going to scare me. You're not going to intimidate me. Whatever you're trying to do from that stage. And I had no real idea then. And I remember him looking at me nodding and then saying, you know, seeming to be okay with the idea that I was tweeting him, liking that, and then telling me that I'd do a good job.
I mean, this, we're going to get into this more and more, but this sort of goes on and off, like, for pretty much the duration of the campaign, where he keeps, he's your friend one moment, he's, you're his enemy another moment. Why do you think he had such a fixation on you?
Lots of people have theories about this.
Yeah.
I will tell you what I know. I was the first network TV correspondent assigned to his campaign full time. I was the first person to take him seriously as a presidential candidate. And I wasn't from some obscure newspaper. I wasn't from some local station. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Right.
I, though, was from NBC News, a national television network, a network that he had worked for.
And for a very measuring president, it's finally like almost he's arrived, and
exactly.
You are the symbol of that arrival.
Exactly. If we take him seriously, then he must be serious. It's the same reason why he always, and Maggie Haberman will tell you this, it's the same reason why he always talks to Maggie Haberman, regardless of how she reports on him, because she is with the New York Times.
Right.
And the status of the New York Times is bestowed on him. So that's one of the reasons. And then another reason could just be very literal. I am a small person. I'm little.
How tall are you?
5'3". There's a great, some like Wikipedia or something says I'm 6'3". I love it. I'm not. I'm a small person, and I was a political neophyte. I wasn't one of the big guns. So there probably was a sense that he thought he could get what he wanted out of me.
So you there's that New Hampshire scene, and you sort of diffuse the situation by saying, hey, I'm tweeting about you, and he's okay with that because it's about him. And then a little while later, you get a one-on-one with him, an interview at Trump Tower. It's sort of a big coup for you because you're the first one to get one of these interviews. Let's set this up by telling me how you felt that interview went, you know, before you saw the footage. What was your feeling of, like, set it up for us?
Listen, I was walking to Trump Tower to do an interview with Donald Trump. You expect there to be some pushback from him. You expect it to be a bit tense because that's who Donald Trump is. He's a guy who was famous for firing people. And so when I walked in, I had some great advice from Chuck Todd, our political director at NBC News, on which questions to ask him and then how to behave if he goes after me. And so I went through with the interview and I asked my tough questions on immigration. I threw up stats that didn't line up with what he was saying. I refused to back down. And after the interview was over, I stood up and I shook his hand and I thought that, you know, regardless of how that went, you're Donald Trump. So it's part of your show. You're going to smile and shake my hand back. That did not happen. He stood up and started screaming at me, saying that you will never be president, he would say to me. You could never be president. You stumbled 3 times. And I remember thinking, why does he care if I stumbled, number one? Number two, I have no desire to be president of the United States. And number three, neither will you. I thought that in my head. Wrongly, I didn't say it. Thank God.
So, and generally you sort of felt like, hey, this is a game. I played the game and like, it's all good. But then you go back to the studio and your producers are looking over the tape and they're like, whoa.
Yeah. So I really didn't understand where his anger came from. I mean, he was threatening to expose me, saying if we didn't air the full interview, he would air it because he was taping it. I remember looking around and seeing no security cameras and thinking if there were security cameras that I didn't see, how would he get the audio? Why was he so angry?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't really get it.
And we have a clip of that interview that we're going to play right now.
Immigration is down. Why is this such a big topic for you right now?
Well, immigration's a very big topic. Take a look at all the crime that's being committed. Go take a look at it.
The
look,
research
I'm
says the crime does not match what you're saying. The
research.
The Pew Research, which is independent, says...
Don't be naive. You're a very naive person.
The Pew Research says that there are, for immigrants on the whole,
Come on, try getting it out. Try getting it out.
I'll get it out.
I mean, I don't know if you're going to put this on television, but you don't even know what you're talking about. Try getting it out. Go ahead.
So what was sort of surprising to me listening to that tape is, you know, I've been in interviews with people who are difficult and they might just roll their eyes and make you feel really uncomfortable in a very passive way. But he went after you so aggressively. It was like he was really trying to bully you.
I remember in that moment thinking he is trying to bully me. He's trying to steamroll me. And I remember very consciously telling myself, close your eyes, take a deep breath, keep going. I was smiling in the entire interview because I just thought the whole thing was a bit ludicrous, the way that he was behaving. The Pew Research showed what he was saying was not true. It's Pew Research. How can you argue with Pew Research? That's like saying I'm going to argue with gravity. Gravity exists. I mean, there's no argument to be had there. And so I just remember like letting it roll off my shoulders. But I sat down in on set at NBC News on MSNBC. We played that whole thing live, not live, uncut for 30 minutes. And I'm sitting next to Chuck Todd, which was weird for me to begin with, because Chuck Todd is, you know, a storied political presenter, moderator at Meet the Press. And I am the least storied political person out there. But watching it play back, I saw what everyone else saw. And I saw what Donald Trump saw, which was that he was extraordinarily angry during the interview. He never smiled once. He was tense. He was spitting out his answers. He clearly went into the interview thinking that it would be a much softer interview. And it wasn't.
I hesitate to even bring this up, but I'm wondering, how much of that do you feel like was because you were a woman and he felt like he could sort of push you around because there is that narrative about him?
Yeah.
Or how much of it was he's just having a bad day, and we also know he's a very mercurial personality who, you know, just...
I think he felt like I wasn't respecting him. And because I wasn't respecting him, he felt like he had to go after me. I think if I was a man, he probably would have been aggressive as well. I don't know if he would have been as aggressive. I can't tell you that. I just know that I don't like to approach my job thinking that somebody is going to inherently treat me differently because I am a woman, because that's BS. I am a good journalist, period. And I don't want to talk about whether or not somebody wants to pick on me because I happen to have different parts than a man.
Well, if you're just joining us, we are speaking to Katie Turr. She's with NBC News and an MSNBC correspondent. Turr has a new memoir out. It's called Unbelievable, My Front Row Seat to the Greatest or the Craziest Campaign in American History. Perhaps one of the greatest.
It's a mouthful. I can't remember the subtitle. Don't tell my editor that.
We're going to open up the phone lines. If you have any questions about the campaign, President Donald Trump or the goings on in Washington, D.C. right now, give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to us at forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. You know, it's interesting, this sort of constant tug of war that you've had with him. So, you know, and we're just going to go through these. So, like, you come out of this interview, he's like really angry and upset with you. And then several months later, you're sitting on the stage of, I guess it's Morning Joe. You're supposed to give sort of a debrief before the candidate Trump comes on. And all of a sudden, he loves you again.
Yeah. So this was it had gone up and down even before this, where he would call me out at rallies over the summer, and then he would try to introduce me to crowds as if I was his wife, trying to present me. So it had been up and down already. And then I was on the set of Morning Joe. They were doing a remote right after the Milwaukee debate, a town hall in New Hampshire. And Donald Trump had flown overnight to appear on their show in the very early morning. I'm on before Donald Trump. He clearly was watching in his plane. And I was asked about the change in tone, because he was nicer on stage than we had been accustomed to. He wasn't going after Ben Carson. At the time, Ben Carson was starting to gain on him in the polls. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump had been just trying to eviscerate him, calling him a liar, etc. He didn't do that during the debate. So I was asked about that, and I gave an answer. And then Donald Trump comes in, and I'm offset. I'm in the hallway waiting. I thought I would greet him and his campaign as he walked in. Already, though, I was feeling tense with the campaign staff because they were difficult to deal with. And he sees me and barrels right towards me. you know, as he does with his jacket flaps open, and grabs me on the shoulders and gives me a kiss on the cheek. And I remember thinking, oh my God, I hope the cameras didn't see that, because this is not a colleague. This mm-hmm. is not a friend. This is not a social situation. This is not even one of my parents' friends. There's in no scenario is it appropriate for a presidential candidate to kiss anywhere a journalist covering that presidential candidate. It's a very serious relationship.
And can you peel that back a little bit for folks who might not know anything about the press and the media? Because I feel like we as yeah. the media don't really explain our jobs
very
well. We
don't. And, you know, it's part of why people have a hard time understanding us. And I think it's part of yeah. why there's a undercurrent of distrust out there. We, in the media, in the press, reporters, especially the reporters who are covering a presidential campaign, have to keep a healthy distance from that campaign. You can become friendly with people on the campaign. You can maybe feel like at some point you could be friends with them, but they're not your friends until you stop covering them. Donald Trump was not my friend. Donald Trump was not somebody that I would go and have a social meal with or a social engagement with. He's somebody that I am covering to run, covering because he's running to lead the country. So there has to be this distance. I have to maintain my, give me the word, I'm blanking.
Yeah, well, I guess sort of boundaries in a way.
My boundaries.
Your personal boundaries, because you can, your colleague, in a way, you're sort of like colleagues, or one might say like you're at different companies, and so you're associates, in that you want to be friendly and civil.
Yeah, you're friendly and you're civil, right. But there's a difference between being friendly and civil and being close.
Right.
And because if it appears like you are being nice to somebody because you are friends with them, or because you are close to them, or because they've done something nice for you, that you lose your objectivity. If Donald Trump wanted to sit down and buy me an expensive meal with a bottle of wine, or anyone that I was covering, mm-hmm. we are not allowed to do that. We can't accept gifts over $20. We can't get too close to the people we are covering, because that can color how we cover them. And not only that, even if it doesn't color how we cover them, the perception is there, and that can eat away at your credibility. So when Donald Trump kisses me on the cheek, it's not like he has assaulted me sexually.
Right.
That is not the case. It is that he has crossed a boundary that makes it look like I can't cover him with any credibility. I can't cover him fairly, and I can't cover him critically if I need to. And obviously I would need to, because he was somebody who was saying what many consider to be outrageous things on a daily basis. So when he did that, I remember thinking, gosh, I hope the cameras didn't see that, because my bosses will not take me seriously. And that's a problem as somebody who's fighting to keep this beat.
Do you think that was intentional, or do you feel like it was just him in the moment?
I think it's him in the moment. I don't think he understands the boundaries. I don't think he understands the rules of decorum in these situations. I don't think he fully understood what the relationship between the press and a presidential candidate should be. I think he always feels like he should be getting favorable coverage no matter what he is doing. He always feels like he should be liked and he should be celebrated. So this situation was no different. And I had said something that he liked on television, and he wanted to let me know that he liked it. So not only did the cameras not catch it, though, which made me feel good, a moment later, he was on camera bragging about it.
I am speaking with Katie Turr. She's with NBC News and an MSNBC correspondent. She has a new memoir out, Unbelievable, My Front Row Seat to the Current the Craziest Campaign in American History. She will be back with us after the break, where we'll be taking some questions. I'm Queen of Kim, and you're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Queen of Kim, in today for Michael Krasny, and here in the studio with us is Katie Turr. She anchors a daily show on MSNBC, but before that, she spent about a year and a half on the road covering candidate Donald Trump's bid for president. She's out with a new memoir of her time covering the campaign. It's called Unbelievable, My Front Row Seat to the Craziest Campaign in American History. We're also opening up the phone lines to take questions. If you have any questions about the campaign, President Donald Trump, or the goings on in Washington, D.C. right now, Katie Turr is here to answer your questions if you give us a call at 866 733 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. And actually, we've got quite a few calls here, so let's just go to them. We have one from Mustafa in Santa Clara. Mustafa, you're on the line.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. My question was about, you know, I think people have done some research into how many billions of advertising Donald Trump got due to news coverage. And I'm wondering if Katie ever felt a sense of regret or guilt in the way that NBC or MSNBC handled the campaign, or if she ever felt guilt about how she handled certain moments.
Well, that's a good question. I never had felt any guilt about how I handled any moments. I think I did my job as best I could. I think there is a discussion and a conversation to be had about how much time Donald Trump was given on television and whether or not that was in concert or fair to the other candidates. I will say this, Donald Trump was unlike anything anyone had ever seen, and he was getting a lot more attention just from the groundswell than the other candidates were, period. He had 20,000 people show up in Mobile, Alabama in August of 2015. That is 6 months before a primary. At this time, the other candidates were getting maybe a couple hundred people, maybe a couple hundred people at rallies. Donald Trump had the reaction to him and the support for him exploded. And it wasn't really because TV was putting him on. It was because he tapped a nerve. He hit a nerve for a portion of the electorate who wanted to hear somebody who refused to back down, to say outrageous things, and to not apologize for it. So we covered him as such. But I do think it's fair to have the argument about whether or not those rallies should have been aired live on television night after night.
I'm sort of curious if you could peel back the onion a little bit for us. Like, what's sort of the broad outlines of that debate as it's happening either at MSNBC or sort of in broadcast?
The debate is, was he such fascinating television that was it the chicken or the egg? Was he somebody that had to be covered because this explosion of interest surrounded him, or did we create that mm-hmm. explosion of interest by putting him on TV all the time? I don't think it's clear cut either way. I think going forward, the way that I would cover a presidential campaign differently if I were the one in charge mm-hmm. of things, I would talk to the voters a lot more. Mm-hmm. I would spend more time on what's going on in their lives, what's going on in their communities, why they're showing up for any particular candidate, why they feel like that candidate is connecting with them or going to be a champion of theirs, rather than seeing the candidate day in and day out, or say, you know, have his rallies day in and day out. Because there was a portion, especially towards the end, where he just said the same thing over and over and over again.
What I found interesting about your book is a lot of people are focusing in like how you're a target for him or whatever, but you offer a really interesting analysis of sort of media coverage in general. And yeah. One thing I sort of picked up on was, even though intellectually you're reading the same polls that show that he was going to lose and sort of all the sort of data out there, somewhere in your gut, if I was reading your book correctly, you weren't totally convinced he was going to lose and he thought he might have a shot at winning. Can you talk a little bit about that disconnect of you as the reporter on the ground and then sort of what you're hearing from on high, you know, both at your headquarters and really across the media landscape?
Absolutely. I thought he was going to win throughout the campaign.
And what gave you that feeling?
Because you don't show up to these rallies and see these thousands of people waiting outside in sub-zero temperatures or 95 degree heat and humidity, or on a Tuesday afternoon. You just don't see those people come out to those things without believing that they are going to find any way they can, no matter hell or high water, to vote for the person that they're doing this for. He had political devotion, sheer devotion from his crowds. They were rabid for him. And we did not see that sort of energy or excitement on the Hillary Clinton side of things. There was also this sense that Donald Trump was so ridiculous, he could not win the primaries. He won the primaries. Donald Trump was so ridiculous that if he said this about John McCain, his poll numbers would tank. No, they didn't tank. They went up. Or if he went after a federal judge, his poll numbers would would tank. No, they didn't tank. He maintained a pretty steady number. Or that he was absolutely going to lose because all of the polls say this and this is what has always happened. In my gut, I just felt like, why are we relying on these things when this man has proven that he can defy all these odds over and over again? I also had a sense that people would tell the polls one thing and do another. My producer and I would have these conversations on the road all the time. You might be embarrassed to support Donald Trump. You might not want anyone else to know, but that doesn't mean that you're not going to actually vote for him when you get into that booth and you pull the curtain behind you and you start to think about your life and whether or not you feel like it's going in the right direction. I understand that feeling. I understand the feeling that people felt like they were being left behind, that they weren't being heard, that their politicians hadn't changed things. They voted for Hope and Change with Obama. Many people got that. A lot of others did not. And this sense that, what do I have to lose with Donald Trump? If I just throw a bomb into the system, will it shake things up? Will we crater and then build something great from the ashes? Or will he shake something loose with the gears of democracy and will Congress start to work again? People held their nose and did that. They didn't necessarily like Donald Trump. They weren't blind to his faults. They weren't blind to the fact that he didn't know much about policy. But there was a sense that, you know, things don't change easily in Washington. Maybe this is what it needs.
Do you sort of touch on a little bit of a disconnect? Because I think I love that bomb throwing analogy. And I think that's a certain feeling people have when they feel like they have nothing left to lose in a way in their lives. And then you have, I guess we could just sort of call them the media elite, whose lives might be going very well. And I guess, do you feel like there was this disconnect that they couldn't understand that people would just want to throw a bomb into the system?
I think that's very true.
Even if they knew that what they were doing might be destructive.
The media in general, I think Washington in general, I think people in cities in general lost touch with what was going on. And certainly the Clinton campaign, you can argue, because this is what happened in Wisconsin and Minnesota and Michigan, lost touch with the average American voter, the ones whose towns, I mean, it all sounds very cliche, but that doesn't mean it's not true. The towns where there's no more mom and pop stores, there's big box stores, kids aren't riding their bikes around towns, young families aren't staying there and finding opportunities there and making their communities thrive. They are leaving to go to other places. Globalization is taking hold. Your computer, you get locked into your computer and you can't get away from it, or your phone, or if you have a problem with your cable box, you call India and somebody from India gets on the phone and can't help you with anything. Nobody seems to care about you any longer. And so when you look at Washington or you look at the media and you don't see those stories, you don't see people coming out and listening to your frustrations or your problems, you don't feel like you are being heard. Somebody like Donald Trump could be very appealing despite all of his many, many, many flaws.
Well, I think Kellyanne Conway had the best line, which is, what offends you might not affect you. And so but let's go to another call here. We've got Ben from Berkeley. Hey, Ben, welcome to Forum.
Hi, thank you. Just a quick comment and a question. The comment is, Katie, I'm a huge fan. I think it's really refreshing to watch your work. I just wish more journalists were like you. So thank you. And the question is, when you watch journalists or programs on, let's say, the BBC, they really put people on the spot, interviewers on the spot. They ask hard questions. And I'm wondering why that isn't the case over here in the U.S. And just curious what journalists can do to kind of reach that level of, let's say, the BBC, for example.
Well, the BBC is an incredible organization. I'm glad you brought them up. And thank you for the kind words you said about me. I think we do ask pretty tough questions. I think if you watch the White House press briefing, I think Sarah Huckabee Sanders, her feet are held to the fire every day by a lot of the journalists in the room. I think whenever certainly somebody comes on one of my shows, I try to press them on as much as I can. I think the British press, though, is they are a tough group of people. No one has any favor with the British press corps. They will tear you apart. And you have to feel bad for the elected officials almost there. But at the same time, they should be able to go up against tough questioning. I think we're finding our footing with that more now today than we had maybe in years past. I do think it obviously can be better. And I think people are really working hard at it. It also depends on what network you're watching.
But he does bring up a point, because when you listen to Hard Talk, have you heard that on BBC?
Yeah.
You know, the presenters there have no problem just talking right over people and even sometimes shouting down their guests,
wow,
right, if they feel like that the guest is giving an untrue or false answer.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, this seems to dovetail into this notion, a little bit of access journalism,
yeah,
which is there's a weird balancing act that reporters, at least in the United States, seem to have to play, in that you want to get access, you want to be able to understand what's happening in these campaigns to serve the public and figure out what's happening. And yet your access is sort of dependent on, I don't know, whether they like you, they respect you.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Is insidious. It's barely journalism.
And explain what it is to folks who don't get what access journalism is.
Access journalism is basically like you described. In order to get a scoop from the campaign to find out who they might be putting in a position or where they might be going, or to get the color of a background meeting, they've got to like you as a journalist. I mean, sometimes they will think that you're fair and they'll give you reporting regardless. And I think we certainly see that with somebody like Maggie Haberman and Glenn Thrush, who are just really fair and really tough journalists who also have the inside track.
From the New York Times.
From the New York Times. And certainly Ashley Parker and Phil Rucker from the Washington Post. And there are others who trade access for friendlier coverage. I don't think that you need to do that. I think access journalism is, as I said, barely journalism. The information that comes out about where a campaign is going or mm-hmm. who they might be putting into a position, that's going to come out regardless. You're going to get it at some point when everyone else gets it. Your scoop on that, getting it 5 minutes before a press release or even a few days before a press release, doesn't actually matter. And there was a point in the campaign trail where, and it's a balancing act because you want to be the one in your organization who has all the information, who can constantly get a comment.
Because you're rewarded for
that. Because
you're
rewarded.
And if you're not
that
person who can just call up the Trump campaign and find out the details, then you're sort of not as useful to your bosses.
You're not as useful.
Or considered that way.
You can be considered that way. And there was a point in the campaign trail where I'm trying to find that balance. And I remember I had come out with story after story that the campaign didn't necessarily like. And I wasn't pulling any punches. When Donald Trump would say something that was not true, I would go out and say it was not true. I fact-checked his speeches day in and day out, either on live television when I had the opportunity, or on Twitter when I could, or in our NBCNews.com or on nightly news. I would really give it a very honest view mm-hmm. of what he was saying and what he was doing. And that obviously contributed to a lot of tension between me and the campaign. And I felt that, you know what, fine. There could be tension between me and the campaign. Ultimately, my journalism is going to show through rather than, hey, I got access to a conference call that my colleagues didn't get access to. It doesn't matter on the larger scale.
Right, and sort of sussing that out while you were on this crazy journey.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I do wish that more there, and I'm not painting a broad brush because I work with some incredible journalists mm-hmm. who do some amazing reporting and ask some really tough questions. But I do wish we just would do away with the idea that we need to have access to them, because ultimately they do need us more than we need them. And if we all really considered that and stood by that principle, then I think this country would be better off.
We have Colin on the line from San Francisco. Colin, you're on Forum.
Good morning, Ms. Turr. The exit polling suggested that a majority of white women voted for Trump even after the Access Hollywood case, in which he brought a non-issue for those voters.
You know, you have to ask about how they felt about Hillary Clinton, if they were willing to vote for that. I was surprised by it. I'm not going to lie. After the Access Hollywood tape hit, I asked every woman that I came into contact with, either at rallies or cab drivers, people I met on planes, every person really, what they thought about it. And I was pretty astonished at some of the answers I got. There was, you know, I tell the story in the book. There was a lady who was walking into a Trump campaign. She was this older woman in a nice flowery dress. A lone protester outside was playing those comments, those Access Hollywood comments, that tape on a loop. I can grab them by the blank, 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 over and over again. And I asked her, what do you think of this? And she said, oh, well, who hasn't said it? And I said, well, I certainly haven't said it. And she looked at me and said, well, good for you. And I asked her, wait, have you said that? Have you said you can grab so-and-so by the P? And she looked at me appalled. Of course I haven't. And then she walked into the rally. So there was a real disconnect between people finding that to be something that they would never say, but then also finding a way to excuse Donald Trump. What I kept hearing over and over again from women especially, more so than men even, was that this is the way men are. This is the way men talk. I'm not going to cast an aspersion on that. That's just Donald Trump. That's just men in general. It doesn't actually matter to me.
Well, we have a comment that's a little along these lines, and a listener asks, Ms. Kim and Ms. Tur are dodging around the fact that she is a sexually attractive young woman. Trump needs to believe he can sexually assault all attractive women and get away with it, as his own unguarded comments and past actions reveal. The thought that he can grab Ms. Tur's private parts and get away with it means he's lost his mojo, and that infuriates him. Of course, they are speaking figuratively here,
yeah.
not literally.
Yeah.
But I mean, I guess there is, I have to say, reading, trying to figure out why he was going after you so much, it felt a little, and I'm not going to articulate this very well, but it felt a little like that boy on the schoolyard who, like, pulls the pretty girl's pigtails because, I don't know, they make them nervous, they're attracted to them, whatever it is. But there was a little bit of this adolescent quality to it that was a little sexually charged. Did that resonate with you at all? Or does this sentiment...
When you say sexually charged...
Maybe they're charged by sexual attraction, maybe we should say.
I don't know if that's true. I don't know if that's true.
Yeah.
I'm not in a position to say whether or not that is true. It's not like... I just don't know if that's true. Is it because I am a female? There's a strong argument to be made for that, given Donald Trump's past behavior, given all we know about him, given all we've heard about him. Yes. But I bristle at it just because I'm a woman, because he did go after men as well. He called a colleague of mine, Tom Yamas, a sleaze. Jim Acosta, a beaut. Same thing to Peter Alexander. He went after them. He didn't go after them as much as he mm-hmm. went after me. And he certainly uses different words for women when you look at his tweets and he talks about either Mika Brzezinski or he talks about Maureen Dowd or anybody. There's a more dismissive quality to his comments when he talks about women. But I think ultimately... what bothered him most was that he could not charm me. He couldn't charm me into being more favorable to him. And this was it's a thread throughout the campaign. And I talk about multiple instances in the book. I mean, it's 510 days. I had a lot of interactions with Donald Trump, you know, both on camera and off camera. Phone calls where he would end the phone call by saying, you know, start the phone call by saying that I was terrible and end the phone call by saying we should be friends. So. You know, it's a hard question for me to answer.
Well, one of the things I thought was most interesting, I saw Hugh Hewitt, the conservative radio columnist, wrote a review of your book in the Washington Post. And he wrote that Tur would often be an unannounced surprise guest star in the reality TV show that was Trump's almost wholly unscripted campaign. And that sort of rang true to me. It was almost like he was trying to bring that reality TV style format to the campaign, and you were sort of like a
part of the act.
A great sort of guest star every once in a while.
Part of the act, yeah. I felt the same way in terms of the reality show aspect to his campaign. And I think a lot of the supporters who went, they came for the show of it. They came to be a part of the show. They knew that when Donald Trump said, you know, who's going to pay for the wall, they knew to say Mexico. When he brought up Hillary Clinton, they knew to chant, lock her up. And when he talked about the media, they knew to turn around and boo the media. It was like going to a rock concert or a you know, an evangelical revival or Baptist revival. There is a call and response between the person on stage and the people in the audience. And so there was that reality show, that circus almost mm-hmm. atmosphere at these events. And I, at points during the campaign, when I think either he saw me in the crowd or he was bristling about something I did or maybe happy about some of the coverage I did because he would go back and forth, he would bring me into it. I know for a fact his campaign was telling him to stop. And he didn't.
Well, I'm speaking to Katie Turr. She's a correspondent for NBC News. She is also an MSNBC live anchor. Turr has a new book out. It's called Unbelievable, My Front Row Seat to the Craziest Campaign in American History. And you are listening to Forum. We are talking, as I mentioned, with Katie Turr. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Queen Akim. So we're back here with Katie Turr. We got another question here. It's from Bertha in Petaluma. Bertha, welcome to Forum.
Thank you. I just wanted to hear your comments on something that I think was under-discussed during the presidential campaign, which was when the Republican candidates protested the use of what they called gotcha questions. I thought that was really extraordinary because I think that's what we should be asking of candidates. And it seemed to kind of go really uncommented on, by and large, in the media. And then secondly, just had a quick comment about there's so much talk about white working class voters being unheard. Lots and lots of talk. And I just there's very little talk about why they persist with that feeling when, you know, minimum wage laws, even the president called the healthcare laws cruel. What is that disconnect, and what are your thoughts on that? And thank you so much.
That is such an interesting question. I'll get to that point first. I think that people don't believe the media. So some people don't believe the media. So when we report out that this healthcare law would not be favorable to the working class, premiums would go up, there's a tendency not to believe us because they want to believe the people they put into power. Journalism makes people uncomfortable, and it should make you uncomfortable. If we're doing journalism and you feel good about your life, then we are doing it wrong. You need to find somebody who challenges your views. And there is a feeling that or there's something that people need to remember. Politicians without journalists, it's just propaganda, what they say. They are spinning you. Remember, politicians are trying to, one, stay in power, to, you know, get their policy through or get their special interests through, protect themselves. I'm not saying all politicians are corrupt, but I mean, that's just something that you have to accept. That's the way politics works. And without journalists coming and shining a light on it, you are not getting the full truth. The disconnect, I think, is just, I mean, it runs so deep in the undercurrent of our politics and the undercurrent of our society right now, I think because of decades and decades and decades of right-wing talk radio and right-wing media saying that journalists are not reliable. They are biased. They are lying to you. They're trying to protect the Democrats. And I think that seeded that itself in a number of voters out there who felt like, listen, I tried 8 years of Democratic leadership. I didn't see my life change materially. I didn't see my paycheck go up. I didn't see minimum wage go up as much as I would have wanted it to. My health care is still spotty, and my premium is high. Why not try something else? So that's the second question. The first question is about the gotcha questions. I think you're right. Gotcha questions are it's if you're going to get caught in a question, then that's bad on you, not bad on the reporter who's asking the question. I think that's just a way for politicians to dismiss reporters. And it's become this phrase, this Pavlov's dog, this dog whistle phrase for anybody out there, for Republicans or Democrats who don't feel like something is fair, who don't want to be held accountable for their answer, who don't want to be asked that question, to try and dismiss the reporters. So you're right. We should be asking gotcha questions.
We have a comment here and something I've heard a lot. It's Davis writes, isn't Trump outsmarting the media by creating superficial distractions while significant changes are being made throughout our judicial and legislative process? Is it almost a purposeful sleight of hand? And I'm sure you heard this, that he's creating all these little fires so that we don't see the big fire in the
back.
I don't
know if it's a purposeful sleight of hand. I think that's just who he is. He's just somebody who wants to control every narrative, who wants to dominate every headline. When things get quiet and he's not in the headlines, you'll find him just say something that will get him right back square into the headlines. I think that we need to remind ourselves that whatever Donald Trump says is one thing, it's what Donald Trump does that we need to watch out for. And there's very little doing as opposed to saying. And the stuff that is being done behind the scenes is getting buried by what Donald Trump tweets or says or the headlines he makes. We have a segment on the show that we try to do at least once or twice a week called While You Weren't Looking. Basically saying, while you weren't looking, Republicans have revived the healthcare debate, or we're not getting the visitor logs for Mar-a-Lago, stuff that is actually quite important that we need to spend more time covering.
But it does raise an interesting question, because I do feel like the journalists are doing sort of the stuff that is really happening as well as the tweets. But in a way, as sort of just a public consumer of news, I find the tweets a little bit more interesting in the stuff that you sort of click on.
I mean, this
you know, and how do you, it's a little bit of a hard conundrum for a journalist,
right? The onus isn't just on us.
Yeah.
It's on you, too. It's on you Americans to say this is what we want, and then to follow through by watching when we cover that stuff and reading when we cover that stuff. If you're not consuming it, we can't put it out there. Remember, this is, I mean, but for better or worse, journalism is a business. And to survive, it needs money. And if you want those issues covered, make sure that you are reading about those issues and you're demanding those issues be covered.
We are speaking to Katie Turr. She's a correspondent for NBC News and MSNBC Live anchor. She's been speaking to us about her new memoir, Unbelievable, My Front Row Seat to the Craziest Campaign in American History. I can vouch for it being a really good read. You should pick it up. And we are finishing with our first hour forum. I'm Queen of Kim, and you are listening to KQED Public Radio. Stay with us after the break.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.